Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
It is Tuesday, the 20th of October. Good morning and welcome to Africa Link with me, Jane Ayeko-Kumet, in Bonn, Germany. In today's edition, Uganda withdraws soldiers from South Sudan.
The UPDF would, of course, protect its borders, and we may not protect our borders in Uganda. We may be forced, you know, to come back and protect our country from insecurity.
Nigeria's Senate approves 18 ministers as screening process continues.
The screening doesn't seem to be all that rigorous as most Nigerians had expected. And people just believe maybe because the president had spoken or had held a meeting with the leadership of the National Assembly, so he just wanted peace to reign rather than have squabbles here and there.
This and more coming up shortly.
Top story.
Ugandan forces will finally withdraw from South Sudan. For nearly 3 years, the Uganda People's Force, UPDF, was stationed in Juba and other major towns. It supported the Sudan People's Liberation Army, SPLA, in the fight against rebels loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar. The UPDF withdrawal is part of the latest peace deal signed on August 26. The agreement aims at ending nearly 2 years of violent conflict that left 1.8 million people displaced. Simona Fulton reports from Bo in South Sudan.
South Sudan's conflict is far from over, but the Ugandan People's Defense Force, or UPDF, is packing up and leaving. A key ally for President Salva Kiir's government, the UPDF was called in to stop the advance of rebels on the capital Juba in January 2014. It also retook the strategic town of Bor, which had changed hands several times in the early days of the conflict. The commander of the forces, Kayanja Muhanga, tells us he is proud of what his troops achieved for both South Sudanese and Ugandan interests.
We stopped the genocide, first of all. There were a lot of killings, and when we captured, since we captured Bor and all the other areas under our control, there has been no killings. Two is that we created a safe passage for trade between Uganda and South Sudan. We also succeeded in creating a peaceful environment along our border between Uganda and South Sudan.
The departure of the UPDF's approximately 3,000 soldiers is to be completed by the end of the month. The move will appease other regional powers who looked suspiciously on Uganda's presence in South Sudan. But although Brigadier General Muhanga says Uganda has no intention to return, it will keep a wary eye on what's happening across the border.
The UPDF would, of course, protect its borders, and we may not protect our borders in Uganda. We may be forced, you know, to come back and protect our country from insecurity, of course.
The withdrawal of the UPDF is the first major milestone in implementing the peace deal. Deadlines for the cessation of hostilities, the assembly and cantonment of troops, and the detailing of provisions for a permanent ceasefire have all passed, with no results. In Juba, the Minister of Information, Michael McCoy, blamed the rebels for the lack of progress.
So we are still waiting for Riek Machar to allow his people to sign the agreement, the minutes of the workshop, so that the operationalization of the permanent ceasefire starts. With that, once he signs, then they will start the assembly, the assembling and the cantonment of the forces in the combat zones. But up to now, there is nothing, and as I, in practically the implementation of the permanent ceasefire arrangements has not yet started.
IGAD, the regional body that mediated the peace agreement, is also running behind its own deadline.
The failure now is from IGAD, who decided to put themselves in the heart of the implementation of the agreement. They are the ones supposed to set up all sorts of commissions and implementation mechanisms which are supposed to be in place. They have not been done up to now. How is it that we are responsible for delaying the implementation?
Several agreements have been signed since the onset of the conflict in December 2013, but so far none of them have brought a breakthrough. In light of the delayed progress, many fear that the latest peace agreement is already unraveling.
Simona Fulton in Bo, South Sudan. And to follow up on that story, my colleague Isaac Mugabe spoke to Fred Nyambera, an expert on South Sudan and executive director of the Fellowship of Christian Councils and Churches in Great Lakes and Horn of Africa. He started by asking him how the withdrawal will impact the security in South Sudan, especially in places where they were deployed.
I believe that the withdrawal, if with a strong political will, should not have any security problem. However, there's a need for this security arrangement to be fast-tracked to make sure there's stability.
One of the reasons why the UPDF was deployed in South Sudan was to ensure law and order at the request of South Sudan's government. Has this objective been achieved?
I don't think that it's been fully achieved because right now the joint security arrangement is not in place. And though SPLM and the security forces of the government of South Sudan are there, if there is no new skirmishes or there is no new conflict, then they are able to guarantee security. But if there is any break in the agreement or if there is any backtracking on the agreement, and the SPLA in opposition decide to engage in more conflict, then there will definitely be a gap in the security.
The presence of Ugandan troops in South Sudan has also been viewed in light of protecting Uganda's economic interests. Now, could we say that the withdrawal would bring this to an end or would put the economic interests of Uganda in jeopardy?
It's not only Uganda, but there have been regional interests when you talk about Uganda being one of them, Sudan being another one, wanting to protect their interests in South Sudan. I wouldn't say Kenya has its own interests, Ethiopia has its own interests. So we would say that Uganda is just one of the players in South Sudan. My view is that the withdrawal of all external forces would be able to minimize this regional interest so that the focus is on South Sudan and their interests and not just the regional interests. Now, whether the interests of Uganda will be protected, again, if there's political will and the diplomatic and political agreement sustained, then I don't think there should be any fear.
We've had different rebel movements using South Sudan's rebel territory as fighting grounds to settle their scores, including actually foreign rebel outfits like the Lord's Resistance Army that belongs to Kony. Now, could the absence of the Ugandan troops bring about the resurgency of these groups?
I believe that for a period of time, there might be some temptation for these rebel groups to regroup themselves and cause some havoc because of the vacuum that might be there.
And finally, how do you assess the overall performance of the Ugandan troops in South Sudan?
When it comes to providing some security and stability, I think they played a major role, not allowing the country just to go in a total disarray. Again, Ugandan forces being in South Sudan might have encouraged some of the opponents of Uganda or some other countries also to be present. For example, Sudan had some interests in staying there, and the fact that Ethiopia was engaged, Eritrea would also want to have some interest and some presence there.
Isaac Mugabe was speaking to Fred Nyambera, an expert on South Sudan.
Get the stories that are shaping the continent here on Africa Link.
Guinea's capital remains calm after President Alpha Conde won a second 5-year term. Past elections in Guinea have been marred by violence, and at least 3 people were killed in clashes in the week just before the latest vote. President Conde's main challenger, Saloum Daline Diallo, vowed not to accept the results, claiming that the election was flawed with fraud and threatened to protest. Now, the government is said to be worried that Diallo's call for peaceful protest could result in clashes and is preparing for possible violence. I spoke to Bram Posthumus, an independent journalist who has been following the elections, about the current situation and what this means for Guinea's future.
The situation in Conakry remains calm from what I keep hearing. And I think the main reason for this is exactly what you mentioned in your introduction, which is the really enormous outburst of violence towards the end of the election campaign. And I've been to the spot where this happened, and the damage is absolutely colossal. Major large warehouses have been burned down, houses have been destroyed, and I think that is exactly the kind of scenario that people are trying to avoid. Now, if defeated opposition leader Saloum Daline Diallo threatens to take to the streets and hold manifestations, then this is almost certainly going to end in a violent outcome. For two reasons. The first reason is that the government, and especially the Minister for Internal Affairs and the Minister for Security Issues, has made it clear that he will not tolerate disorder in Conakry or anywhere else for that matter. And secondly, that the incitements to go out and protest are also attracting a large number of people with different intentions.
What exactly is government doing to prevent any outbreak of violence?
What government has been doing so far is to send large numbers of police and other security forces into areas where they suspect that this will happen. And unsurprisingly, these are indeed the opposition strongholds. So there is an important, what they say, an important dispositif, as they say there, a large security force on the ground. Occasionally you can also see army helicopters flying overhead, surveying the ground, seeing if there is any trouble. And apparently it is basically designed to intimidate people into not going out on the streets and to protest. And that seems to be working so far.
State security forces have been implicated in past violent demonstrations. In case of any violent outbreak, do we expect the situation to be the same, or are things going to change this time round?
To that, I have to say this, that there have indeed been bursts of violence in the first 5 years of the Alpha Condé presidency. But you have to remember this comes against the historical context in which there have been huge massacres, the stadium massacre in 2009, the mass shooting of demonstrators on the streets of Conakry in 2007, and of course the systematic violence of the Sékou Touré presidency between 1958 and 1984. So in that sense, yes, there has been violence, there have been deaths, there have been quite a number of deaths over these past 5 years. As President Condé keeps repeating, it is difficult to make security forces who have always been a law unto themselves suddenly try to make them behave properly and in a republican fashion, which means that they are there and they need to understand that they are there to protect the public and not attack citizens.
Diallo only threatened that he will demonstrate, he will go to the street, and this is why the government is reacting the way it's doing. But he did not indicate when exactly he's likely to carry out this demonstration. Are you aware of any speculation that could be indicating as and when the protest could happen?
No, not really. And actually, this is an interesting point that you're raising, because what is happening here, that the opposition's bluff has been called. You know, last Monday, they already decided that the elections had been fraudulent before even the first result was known, or even the first provisional result was known. One of the reasons why the opposition leader Diallo may not be so forthcoming with exactly when these demonstrations are happening is that his rank and file may well be beginning to tire a little bit of being sent out on the streets pretty much like cannon fodder for an opposition leader who has lost an election.
I was speaking to Bram Posthumus. He's an independent journalist specializing in West Africa.
Africa on the move.
Tanzania's government wants to improve living conditions for small farmers. The aim is to produce more food and to ensure that growing needs will be covered in the future. Big companies are to support the farmers in these efforts. As Assumpta Latus reports, the strategy is under some condemnation.
Betrida Kayega and her five children are preparing rice that they need to take to the market. The last crop Betrida harvested on a tiny piece of land behind her house was very successful, and now she's able to sell some surplus rice.
We got more yields than before. If I was getting 8 bags from 1 acre, and now I'm able to get 30 bags from 1 acre.
Around 7,500 farmers from Kilombero region have come together to improve their rice production. They're being trained by Richard Hunger. Hunger got his training from Africa's largest rice producers, KPL, to share with other farmers what he learned.
So you'll be using a small hoe to dig small holes, which you already prepared by using ropes of 25 centimeters. You dig a hole, put your seeds in it, but before you put in seeds, you put fertilizer, you put the seed, and then you cover it with soil.
By the end of this century, there will be four times as many people to feed in Africa as there are now, an indication that food production will clearly have to be boosted. The biggest challenge is to improve the small farmers' livelihood at the same time. The KPL farm in Kilobero District, Morogoro region, is being held up as a model of private investment. It is one of the East Africa's largest rice farms, covering almost 6,000 hectares of fertile River Valley land. The investment in local small farmers is supported by the Tanzanian government. Besides aiming a better production for the farmers, KPL also promises to buy all surplus rice. But the company pays a lower price than local markets, a point that has been highly criticized. Victor Mayong is skeptical. The agricultural economist at the International Institute for Tropical Agriculture says small-scale farmers are getting a raw deal.
Is it a model that can just be copied and pasted? I will say no. Is it a model that can be scaled out and replicated with adaptation? Yes. I would say yes. It is possible. But we need to learn from the mistake made in Kilombero so that we don't repeat them elsewhere.
The farmers' crops are often threatened by pests and floods, and they have to carry all the risks. Victor Mayong feels this is a good deal for KPL, despite the company insisting they help farmers have an additional source of income.
If the foreign companies will be dealing with that scheme, they will impose their condition, and the small-scale farmers, they will not benefit that much. This is where the government, at least at the beginning of those schemes, the government should come in, because the government is powerful enough to bring policy instrument.
Betrida Kayega and her family still take part of their produce to the local market instead of selling it to KPL, since that way she gets more profits for a sack of rice. At the same time, she saves costs by cutting out the middlemen.
That was Jane Nyingi with a report by Assumpta Latus. In Nigeria, the upper chamber has so far screened and approved a number of ministerial nominees. On October 12th, the Senate received an additional 16 new names, completing the required total of 37. The Senate received the list from the Chief of Staff to the President, Abba Chari. But as DW's Muhammad Alamin reports, the long-awaited exercise has attracted both positive and negative criticisms.
The Nigerian Senate has already cleared 18 ministerial nominees out of 37 names received from President Muhammadu Buhari. The vetting process that started on Tuesday last week has attracted mixed reaction from different sections of Nigerians.
My name is David Ayodele. We have a number of people of credible integrity among them, quite all right. But the screening doesn't seem to be all that rigorous as most Nigerians had expected. And people just believe maybe because the president had spoken or had held a meeting with the leadership of the National Assembly, so he just wanted peace to reign rather than have squabbles here and there.
My name is Ezekiel Titus. Actually, I'm very happy the way what is happening at the National Assembly, especially in respect of the screen exercise, had never happened in the history of this country, because the exercise is very transparent, is yearning towards giving out the best hands for Nigerian citizens.
Before the screening started, Senate President Bukola Saraki assured Nigerians that the exercise will not be business as usual. So far, the nominees have no portfolios attached to their names. Nevertheless, Nigerians are eager to see the outcome.
We are waiting to see what is being put in place for them to key into this anti-corruption crusade. Each one of them should be held responsible for his own misdemeanor. That is the only way for President Buhari to convince Nigerians that he is for real.
Actually, my expectation is high considering the nominees, because most of them, actually, they are technocrats and experts in various fields of endeavors.
He has to lead on his own plans for them, and then that's not enough. We should have something like ombudsman kind of a team, people that will monitor their performance, and then the government itself should be able to equally do the same.
But political analyst Shehu Umar is not convinced with the whole process.
To be honest with you, it's not what the Nigerian Senate promised Nigerians. They promised Nigerians they are going to grill these nominees. But I think no really serious questions were asked these nominees. It's a kind of smooth sail for them. I don't know whether it is deliberate, whether it is planned, or it's a written script.
Muhammad Alamin in Nigeria.
Making a difference.
countries, pollution of the environment by plastic bags has become a great concern. In Cameroon, one entrepreneur is turning that trust into innovation. Pierre Kamsloom has started a plant that specializes in reusing plastic waste. One of his products is pavers used for walkways. The plant, located in the capital Yaoundé, is being funded by the former Cameroonian football legend Roger Miller. This report by Matthias Bullinger has been adapted for Africa Link and is now presented by Fred Muvunyi.
For most Cameroonians, plastic waste is just trash, but not so for Pierre Kamsulumu, who sees it as a valuable resource. In collaboration with other businessmen, he laid the foundation stone for a plastic recycling plant in Cameroon.
When we were children back in the village, we often sat around the fire and bend old plastic bags. They often melted, and from that we made balls.
Statistics from the Ministry of Environment show that 600,000 tons of plastics are produced in Cameroon each year and not properly disposed of after use. Pierre says the plastic recycling plant will protect the environment and create employment. Before the plant is completed, Pierre is running a so-called cobblestones workshop where he's working on his project of making bricks from plastic. He first melts the waste plastic bags, mixes the liquid with sand, and then powers the mix into brick mold shape. When it dries up, the process is complete. The workshop, it's just some few weeks out, and Pierre says lots still need to be done.
We lack breathing masks. I haven't found any yet. I want the people to wear breathing masks, especially when replacing the filter. We need them.
The workshop is a flagship project of the recycling plant that has been made possible by one-time world best footballer in the 1990 World Cup. Roger Miller, who is now a soccer ambassador, is funding and also patronizing it through his Heart of Africa Foundation. Miller, who is now 63 years old, was one of the African top players on the international stage. He played in 3 World Cups for the Cameroon national team.
When you finish your football career, then you have to find something to do. I decided to look for ways to help young Cameroonians.
Many other prominent people have praised the project, including Cameroonian French pop star George Seba.
I saw on television a documentary about it, and I was very much interested to have a look at it. I think it's something that really needs to be supported.
Building materials, in particular cement, are becoming increasingly expensive in Cameroon, and the idea of an alternative building material made of plastic waste will come as a relief to many. For years, Pierre Kamsroom sold the idea to many other African countries, but Roger Mira decided to bring him back to Cameroon. His dream now is to build dozens of such workshops across Cameroon and see his idea being used in walkways across the country.
Fred Muvunyi with that report by Matthias Bullingham.
Listen to Africa Link whenever you want. Sign up for our podcast at dw.com/Africa Link Podcast.
And now a reminder of our top stories. Uganda withdraws soldiers from South Sudan, and Nigeria Senate approves 18 ministers as screening process continues. Remember, we welcome your opinion on this program. Do send us a text message to +491609575910 or an email to feedback.africa@dw.com. Or send us a letter to Africa Link, DW 53110, Bonn, Germany. That's all we have for you today. Africa Link returns tomorrow at the same time. From me, Jane Ayeko Kumet, enjoy the rest of your day.